Welcome to the Spoolcast. Dan Saffer joins Jared Spool in a discussion about micro-interactions. Dan will be presenting one of the day-long workshops at the User Interface 19 Conference October 27th through 29th in Boston. For more information, visit uiconf.com. That's uiconf.com. And now, here's Jared.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Spoolcast, and today we're talking micro-interactions with Mr. Dan Saffer. He's going to be giving a full-day workshop on how to design micro-interactions at the User Interface Conference, which is going to be October 27th through 29th in Boston, Massachusetts. But today we're going to talk about the book he wrote, which is cleverly named Micro-Interactions, and what they are and how they work and all those good things. And Dan, how are you?
I am great, Jared.
Yeah.
So you sound great to be back and talking micro interactions again. Yeah, no, it's a sunny, happy day here in San Francisco. So what could be ill?
There you go. So one of the things I've been really interested in lately is sort of the language that is beginning to form around the more subtle and nuanced parts of design. And micro-interactions is one of these things where, you know, before your book came out, before I had a chance to read it, it never even occurred to me that this was a thing. And then it turns out that as I'm reading the book, I'm realizing it's not just a thing. It's like all this different stuff. And you've got triggers and feedback and all these things. And you've had to come up with a language to describe this. I'm curious how much of what you put in the book was language that you'd taken, that you'd found in other places, and how much of it you had to sort of create on your own. I was reminded of Gray's Anatomy, not the TV show, but the big book written by Henry Gray in the 1850s, which is still in use today. And
you're not a fan of McDreamy or McSteamy or whatever the...
No, I watched the first season because I was dating a woman who was very into it. And then we stopped dating, and for some reason I stopped watching.
Yeah, funny how that happens, right?
Yeah, so I don't even know what happened beyond the first season. As far as I can tell, probably the same thing that happened in the first season.
Yeah, I think people fell in love and they fell out of love and there was tragedies and people died and people lived.
Right, and then every episode there's some crazy surgery thing that happens or somebody comes into the ER with, you know, aliens coming out of their belly.
I have never seen a single episode, and it's a badge of honor for me.
Oh, and dude.
Back to the original Grey's Anatomy.
There are brain cells that you have still intact that I have lost. But yes, back to the original Grey's Anatomy. So have you read this? The plot's a little thin, but the characters are great. But no, it's this giant book. It's got every piece of the body in it, both inside and out. And the thing about it was, and I remember reading this, was that Gray and Carter was the illustrator, Gray was the creator, they struggled because it turned out that there were lots of parts of the body that had no name. And I'm wondering if that's sort of what you ran into as you were putting the book together.
Definitely. There certainly were a lot that I kind of made up. I mean, but certainly not the term micro-interactions, which has been around for several decades now. The very first instance of people using it was actually in sociology, where people were using it as micro-interactions between individuals.
Oh, interesting.
That was, yeah, starting back in like the 1970s, there was a kind of wave of these, you know, micro-interactions. And you'll still see people using it as that today, particularly in things like service design. But the HCI community started to pick it up in like the 1980s, early 1990s, and you start to see it start to appear in the literature then. So luckily, I didn't have to make up the term micro-interactions. That was kind of already out there and waiting for me to start to appropriate and grab and flesh out. When I started to put together the model, that's when I started to have to think about at least what the general pieces were. That's when I had to think of things like trigger, rules, feedback, and loops and modes. Now, certainly some of those have, you know, feedback, you know, was certainly out there. Modes were certainly out there. So really, it was all about triggers, rules, and loops were kind of the biggest pieces that I had to kind of start to put a name around. Just at kind of a high level, one of the reasons I actually wrote the book was so that we did have in the general design lexicon a term that everyone used and thought about when it came time to design these little details. Because often I was finding in my own work that I'd be like, well, I just need some time to work on this little thing, or I need time to polish this, or I just didn't have a good term for it. And so when I started thinking about what the things were that I really liked about products, a lot of them turned out to be these micro-interactions. And lo and behold, there was already a name for it.
What were some of the micro-interactions that sort of stood out that made you really like the products you were using?
I mean, some of them stood out just because they were clever, or they did something in a way that was unexpected and unexpectedly delightful. Like there was something fun about them, or there was something about them that had a really deep connection to the activity that I was doing. So I use the example of the Breville toaster a lot. And the Breville toaster, it's this really nice toaster. Like every other toaster toasts, but when the toast pops up and you look at it and you're like, oh, I need a little bit more toasting, there's actually a button that says a little bit more, and you press the button, it toasts a little bit more. So what I love about it was that someone like thought about the activity and said, you know what? What would be something really interesting and delightful here that shows this deep understanding of the activity of toasting, which is something that you could be like, eh, it's toasting. How hard could it be? But somebody actually thought about that activity and thought about what would really make it something interesting, something special, and something premium. I mean, that's the thing that I think about. I mean, these Breville toasters are $125. I mean, you can go to Target and get a toaster for $20. But the thing that's really setting it apart is this attention to detail. And so when I started looking around at the things that I really loved and enjoyed using, it was all about that attention to detail.
Yeah, I have a Breville smart oven. And I love it. And one of the things that's cool is that in addition to bake, it also has roast, which is cool, but it also has cookies and pizza, right? They just figured out what you need to do for cookies. They figured out what you need to do for pizza. And they're just preset setups. And the pizza one, instead of putting in how long you want it to cook, you put in whether the pizza is frozen or fresh and how many inches in diameter it is. And then it figures out the rest. And again, it's a simple little preset, but it's brilliant in terms of it takes a lot of the thought out of it. And again, it feels like someone has really thought about the task and what people are doing.
It's a more sophisticated popcorn button on your...
Yeah, I was thinking that. But, you know, the thing is that all the little packages of microwave popcorn tell you to never use the popcorn button. I think that's because every microwave, even though they now all have popcorn, they all implement it differently and they emit a different pattern of radiation or whatever it is they're doing. And the popcorn doesn't work. It's not designed for that.
Interesting. I use it here for our office at work and it works perfectly. It is exactly right. So...
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, and you know what? Maybe it's just office popcorn microwaves that are that good, because our office one here works perfectly too, now that you mention it. So it's interesting to me that you had to create this language. Was that something, as an author, you struggled with a little? Because, you know, you don't just want to put words out there or terms that have completely other meanings that everybody is using, and then suddenly find yourself constantly saying, no, not that type of loop, this type of loop.
Yeah, I mean, loop actually was the one term that did bump into some existing, like, adjacent areas where people had already thought about loops, and that was in programming. I mean, there is a programming term for doing a loop, and the loops that I talk about in the book are slightly different. So this is where technical editors come into play, where, you know, a lot of my technical editors said, you know, hey, this is slightly different than the loops that we talk about in development. So I was able to at least in the book talk about like how the two terms differ in using them. But other stuff I simply stole from other kind of adjacent areas. So I had read the book, The Power of Habit, right before I was working on the Microinteractions book. One of the terms that they use is trigger, a trigger for a habit. And I thought that was a great kind of term for what I was looking for the start of a microinteraction. And then I just had to kind of differentiate between manual triggers and system triggers, manual triggers being the button pushes or the clicks on links or the clicks on an icon or a wave or those kinds of things that people do to start a microinteraction versus a system trigger, which is a set of conditions that happens when a system detects that, oh, here's a number of things that are going on and they match this pattern. And so then I'm going to go launch this microinteraction. So after the book came out, I found out that there was a lot of literature talking about explicit versus implicit triggers. And that's certainly something that this maps directly to, that I hadn't really heard that language, but there was definitely something out there already that kind of fit that existing pattern. And it's funny, actually, side note on triggers, since I have the word triggers on the Microinteractions website, for the reason that people thought it was a gun enthusiast website, it was actually blocked from a lot of people's firewalls. Like, they wouldn't let them out to see it because it had the word trigger in it. Unexpected consequence of naming something that I thought was fairly innocuous, but apparently Google thinks that microinteractions.com is a gun site. So
that's crazy. For many years, we had an article, well, we still have the article, but for many years, it would show up in the top five most Googled articles on our website for no real reason. And it turned out the article was about using the multiple personalities of personas to make design decisions. And because it had the phrase multiple personalities, a lot of people are looking for multiple personalities in the Google, apparently, and end up on our website. And then I'm sure are horribly disappointed when they realize that they're going to have to build something to deal with it.
Right. I can solve all my problems with just these pieces of paper. Wow. Yeah. And then, I mean, the last one that I came up with just in general was rules. And that was just because a lot of the stuff I was influenced by was thinking about kind of these little bits in game design. And I was thinking like, wow, you know, how do these little things work? The original term I was going to use for rules was interaction. But I thought that might be too confusing because...
So what's an example of a rule?
An example of a rule is basically once a microinteraction has been triggered, it's what happens. It's
okay, that makes perfect sense.
Exactly. I mean, so once something gets started, what happens? What's the sequence of events and the kind of invisible constraints about what you can and can't do in this microinteraction? So here's where the data is coming from. Here's what happens when you press this button. Or if you notch this slider up, you know, every notch is increasing the volume by, you know, 1% or 3%. So basically the rules are defining what happens and the sequence of what happens. And that's why I tried to call them rules. They're kind of like the rules of a game. Here's how you play this microinteraction.
So part of that's the display, but part of that is also what's happening behind the scenes.
Yeah, I mean, the rules, for the most part, are completely invisible. You don't exactly know what's happening except for the feedback that you get. The next part is basically the feedback is just showing how the rules work. So if you have bad feedback or misleading feedback, it leads you to think that how something works is different from how it actually does work.
I would guess another way people surface the rules is through preference settings. You know, those plethora of settings of, do you want me to beep 3 times or 2 times when you get this message?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely ways you can alter the rules through settings and through modes. It would be another thing that, hey, you're going to go into a special mode where the rules are slightly different. Like a lot of interaction designers, I'm not a huge fan of modes. And so they're definitely something that I want to emphasize, that I emphasize using them sparingly, but they can occasionally be really helpful.
Yeah, so I was thinking about the way iOS 7's notifications work. And sometimes the notifications appear at the top of the screen, and sometimes the notifications sort of stop you what you're doing and have this dialogue box that you have to dismiss. And those would be two separate sets of rules for notifications, and I guess deciding which way you're going to go. One is modal, one is non-modal.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there are definitely tons of rules behind the scenes about, you know, where it appears and what happens when it appears and how do users dismiss them? What happens if you ignore them? What happens if you're offline when it happens? You know, so more sophisticated a piece of functionality is, the more rules that are generally embedded inside it.
When people are designing these things, part of this feels like, well, that's just the programming behind it. But there's a lot of intentional design that you want to think through. And I would think the designer would really, probably in conjunction with whoever's doing the implementation and other people on the team, wants to have a say and be talking through what happens when we're offline and what happens when we don't have a good internet connection and all those types of things that feel at the outset as being, well, that's a technical detail. I don't have to worry about that as a designer. But there is a lot of subtlety and nuance there, right?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it all impacts the user experience as a general thing. And so the question is, who's doing your user experience? You know, who's designing it? Is it going to be you, or is it going to be, you know, the developer who's putting it together? I mean, ultimately, it's going to be a mash of both. But who's doing those initial parameter settings and definitions of the rules? I mean, and I would hope that designers would take the lead on that and help to define these things, because it does make a big difference to the user experience. I don't know about you, but I can almost always tell when a piece of functionality has been kind of neglected and left to, like, oh, you know, somebody else is going to figure that out. And so it's always a piece that just doesn't feel as polished. It feels kind of clunky. And sometimes it's around error messages. Sometimes it is around these kind of, you know, odd edge cases that people haven't thought through in a careful way or tried to design around. So all of a sudden you get this very strange error message. And these are things that when people bump into them or they have to engage with them, that it makes you question the quality of the overall product, that you're like, oh, wow, this is really clunky, or this is a not great experience. And you were just mentioning the iOS 7 notifications. And to me, that's just a mess. Like,
yeah, it feels like a mess.
It definitely does. I mean, like, there's multiple places where you can change the notifications, and I don't know, it just does not feel like it has been thought through all the way.
Michael Lopp, who writes as Rands in Repose, had this fabulous piece a few weeks ago called Designing for Gullible, which talked about how the basic frustration I have, which is I get this notification on my phone and I swipe the phone for whatever reason, and now the notification is gone, but I don't know what app it came from, and I don't know how to find it again. There is this thing, this notifications panel that I can bring up, but I can't ever find anything useful in it. It's really crazy.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It just feels like a mess.
And every app, the minute I start the app, says, would you like me to be able to push notifications to you? And I'm like, okay, why would you ever do that? Explain to me why I want this. You know, why is my supermarket checkout app? So the supermarket I go to is Stop and Shop here in Boston, and they have a fabulous app that just lets me scan things as I go, and then I walk up to the self-serve register and I swipe my keychain tag, and it says, oh, here's all the things you've put in your cart. Here's the total. Just pay. And I don't have to go through the actual checkout process. It's figured that all out as I've been going. I love this thing. But the first thing it says to me is, would you like notifications? And I'm like, what notifications would you want to be telling me? You know, are they going to tell me that there's, you know, cheese is on sale at the deli? I don't know what it is. But no, I don't want your notifications. But there's no explanation.
I mean, you don't know what the value is. To you
exactly.
To be. I mean, if it said, like, here's the kinds of things that we're going to be showing you that, you know, hey, you're right near something that will save you money or blah, 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 you might say yes. But yeah, with a lack of knowledge, the first time you open it, especially before you've ever even used the app, you've no idea what you're agreeing to.
Yeah. It's like if, you know, the first time you and I were introduced at an event, I walked up to you and I shook your hand and I said, would you like push notifications for me?
Right. Right. Can you give me the key to your house?
And yeah, that's right. That's right. I'm going to come in and shout at you in the middle of the night. So would it be fair to say that micro interactions have really been in the design of online digital systems forever, but only recently have we started actually explicitly thinking about their design? And before, we just sort of left it up either to chance or to the technical person who had their fingers in the code, who said, well, what am I going to do when this error happens? Oh, I guess I'll put up this message that says system error.
I think that would be partially true. So they have certainly been in every digital product that has existed. I think going back in time to the late 60s, early 70s, and even all the way up through the early 80s, so much of what people were trying to figure out was the micro interactions for operating systems. So things like scroll bars and cut and paste, and you know, how you open a window, how a window closes, how a page scrolls.
Yeah, I was there for all that. We were trying to figure out all those little interactions. And there was a huge debate on which direction the scroll bars should work and which side of the screen they should be on. And there was a big contingent that believed that the scroll bar should be on the left side of the screen because that's where the text was.
I haven't heard that little piece of
Yeah. The MIT crowd. So if you look at X Windows and the Andrew system that came out of CMU, they all have the scroll bars on the left. And the Stanford Xerox folks all had them on the right. It was an East Coast, West Coast thing.
It was battle, yeah.
So the left coast wanted them on the right, and the right coast wanted them on the left.
Well, we won that one, I suppose.
You did.
But it's interesting. I've actually seen like a list of, you know, you can like look at the scroll bars and how they've evolved over time.
So oh, yeah.
You could really say that the history of technology has got this kind of shadow history of micro interactions that kind of manage and control and kind of live alongside this technology as to how you manipulate it. So
right. And one of the big advances in scroll bars, I remember this, was it had nonlinear movement. So if you have a really big document in the early days, scrolling down was the same amount of text. So that meant that if you pulled down really hard, it took forever to get to the bottom of the document. It was not the same speed. Then they said, okay, well, if I pull down really fast, I'll get to the bottom of the document. But then it became really hard to pinpoint a specific place. Like if I just want to go down two screen worths and I have a really long document, that was really hard to do. So somebody at, I think it was Xerox, though it might have been Microsoft, I'm pretty sure it was Xerox, came up with the idea of if you scroll really fast, so if the mouse is moving really fast, it moves a large piece of document. But if it's really slow, the amount of document it moves is just a percentage of that. And it was an exponential graph, not a linear graph. And as a result, it gave you gross control and fine control. And that seems to me to be a micro interaction that's really complicated that people don't realize. I mean, if you play with a long document or a long web page, you'll see it, but it feels natural the way it works. And you don't think about it.
And what you're describing right now is going back 5 minutes into this podcast is a rule. You know, they tinker with the rule until it made sense for the context of it.
What I was describing was that I'm a really old dude.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So, you and me both, man.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that we reached a point where sometime in the early to mid 80s, where a lot of the, you know, GUI conventions were kind of set. And then I think there was another kind of burst of people thinking about micro interactions around the time that the web was new and trying to figure out, you know, once again, people started thinking like, well, how does the scroll bar work? How does the back bar work? You know, what are the kind of conventions of the web? And then we've had another burst kind of when, you know, mobile really started to take off. Well, how do you do this in mobile? How do you go back? How do you go forward? How do you launch an app? all those kinds of things. So I think there have been times where people have definitely focused on micro interactions as being part of the overall operating system, or, you know, the overall flow of how things work. What I think is, I don't want to say new, but what I think is causing kind of a resurgence of micro interactions are the fact that so many products now, the feature set are very commoditized. Like, there's not a lot of huge differentiators and features across all these different kinds of products. And what the differentiators end up being is all about the user experience. And what the user experience can be boiled down to are, you know, these big features, obviously, but also the micro interactions that surround and control and make them into something interesting. I mean, we talk a lot about, you know, look and feel, but micro interactions are the feel kind of part of look and feel. And so you see these companies that are trying to use micro interactions as a strategy. Well, they say, well, we may have an app that is just for sending and receiving mail, but we're going to make it a really polished, like the best in breed that we possibly can. And that means we're going to focus on every micro interaction. And this is what Mailbox app did. And, you know, they were acquired practically before they even launched. So I think it is kind of micro interactions as a strategy, like looking at, you know, how can we make this thing just of such high quality that it becomes a differentiator in the marketplace for us? And I think that's something to me that feels new. This is not to say, of course, that there hasn't been, you know, products of quality in the past, because of course there have been. But I think it's a deliberate focus on that that is really something that is really exciting and interesting, and we're seeing a lot of right now.
That's really interesting to me. I mean, I think that the idea that it's these little details that are making the difference between one product and another, it feels very much like what we've seen in architecture or in the automotive industry. Or, you know, a car is a car is a car for most consumers, but, you know, the cup holders and just the ease of the radio system, or how the GPS works, or, you know, the styling of the dashboard starts to make a difference from one car to the next.
I mean, it is definitely a way of working that I think particularly a lot of industrial designers have done for many, many years. I mean, it's, you know, a chair is a chair is a chair, except the details really make an Aeron chair different from, you know, another kind of chair, and, you know,
plastic lawn chair.
Exactly. I mean, there are big differences, and really thinking about those details is definitely something that, you know, people like the Ameses, you know, were certainly big into that. And, you know, Dieter Rams, I mean, that detail is like his whole thing. Like, he talks about, you know, the details are the differentiator for him. Like, that's what he focuses on in order to make his products really stand out and make them really great.
So maybe the reason that micro interactions has become such a hot topic lately is because we've matured to the point where this is now something we can focus on. We're not just, you know, trying to teach a horse to talk, as the old joke goes, but now we actually care about what it says and how it says it.
I think that's right. I mean, I think that we've reached a level of technical sophistication now, where pretty much, you know, there's very few things that can't be done in some way now. Obviously, there's new technologies and new stuff always coming down the pike, but I think that there's a plethora of really amazing digital technology in particular. Things that were tremendously hard even 10 years ago are now extremely possible. I mean, Moore's Law is just making things go crazy practically, because we're just so much better than we were back in the 90s or back in the 80s. And you have hundreds and hundreds of times more processing power in your phone than they did to send a man to the moon. You know, those kinds of crazy statistics that are out there.
Right.
And I think now that we have reached this level of technical sophistication, yeah, the idea of what are you going to do with it and how are things done, I think just becomes much more of a thing. I think we saw this starting in consumer, but I specifically see it now a lot in enterprise. Like, a lot of people are saying, like, why is all this consumer stuff? They focus on how nice the details are and how nice things are, but I'm stuck with this enterprise system from 10 years ago and it's really clunky. Why can't it feel as polished and as quality as the consumer stuff that I have all around me?
Right. Well, Dan, thank you so much for talking to me about this. This has been really fascinating.
Yeah, this has been a whirlwind tour through design history and technology. So
yes, it has been.
Yeah.
If you guys are interested in learning more about microinteractions, first, go out, buy Dan's book with the clever name of Microinteractions. It's a fabulous book to read, and it will sort of change the way you think about all this. And then, if you're still excited about this, here's what I want you to do. I want you to go to uiconf.com, that's uiconf.com, and check out Dan's full-day workshop on microinteractions. Last year, he gave this workshop, and it was really the highlight of the conference. It really was so much fun. There are all sorts of exercises and stuff, and Dan does a fabulous job. And you want to go explain to your boss that for you guys to be competitive in the world, you have to learn about this stuff and be really awesome at it.
It is definitely a very fun day. Well, it's been road tested around the world now. And what I really like about it and what I heard a lot of from attendees about is how practical it is and how hands-on it is and how they can take it back to their work the next day and start to apply it and start to think about it, which I think is really great. And that's the whole point of this, is that it was meant to be a practical, hands-on talk, but also one that should expand your mind into thinking about, you know, how you could take your product to the next level. I'm really happy that attendees are coming away with that.
Yeah, it's a great mind-expanding thing, so much so that people told us they needed to change the little strap on their hats to be one size bigger. Now we're getting silly. Dan, thanks for talking with me.
Hey, thanks for having me. This was a fun discussion.
And I want to thank our audience for listening. And again, check out Dan's workshop at uiconf.com. That'll be October 27th through 29th, Boston, Massachusetts. And thanks for encouraging our behavior. We'll talk to you soon. Take care.
For more information about Dan's and the other 7 workshops, visit uiconf.com. That's uiconf.com. As always, thanks for listening.